anything that they would like to raise in the way of a question or comment, either related to your meditation practice or to the discussion that we've been having that we began last night. Yes.
Through this meditation practice, if nothing else, I have experienced that dukkha.
You've experienced dukkha?
Yes.
Has it helped you to...
The First Noble Truth.
Yeah, has it helped you to realize the truth of dukkha and the nature of dukkha?
Yes, definitely.
It definitely has. That's very good. Nothing could be more important than to understand the nature of dukkha. It is, the very first teaching that the Buddha ever gave after his enlightenment. He went in search of his five companions who he had been with for several years while practicing austerities according to other traditions. And the very first teaching that he gave, that is recorded in the sutras, is called the turning of the wheel of the Dharma. And it's about the Four Noble Truths. It's the way that he began the whole teaching. And in many, many senses, it's at the very core of the understanding of Buddhism. And usually when somebody writes like Walpole Ruhula's book, What the Buddha Taught, and many of the excellent books that have been written sort of introducing people to Buddhism, always start with the Four Noble Truths. It makes really good, it's really the right place to start. And the first truth is the truth of dukkha. And the first thing that people need to understand about that, and probably most of you do, but I know not everyone everywhere does. We usually translate dukkha as suffering in English, but it actually has a much broader meaning than that. It means every kind of unsatisfactoriness. The root word dukkha actually refers to the axle hole in a wheel, and dukkha is an axle hole that's not completely round. So can you imagine what it's like riding in a cart where the axle hole of the wheel is not round? It makes for a very uncomfortable ride. So dukkha encompasses everything from the most mild discomfort or annoyance through to the most extreme physical or mental suffering. It covers everything. It basically takes everything that is unsatisfactory, dissatisfactory, everything that you would like not to experience, and it encompasses it all. And included in that, of course, is that sort of existential suffering of wondering, what on earth is this all meaning and purpose? What is this all about anyway? Because the more you come to realize how much suffering is involved in human existence, the more that particular question becomes its own source of dissatisfactoriness, you see. With the one thing that you can be sure of is everything that you love, you're going to lose. That is the one absolute certainty, right? And so that leads to the question, well, why then? What on earth is this all about? Why are we born into this situation? So dukkha, the first step is to recognize the way that dukkha completely pervades human existence. And then is to understand it. And that teaching is very interesting because it's The one that's given in the sutra I mentioned, the one called Turning of the Wheel of the Dharma, because it's fairly concise. As a matter of fact, that whole sutra can be recited in less than 20 minutes, yet it took several days of talking day and night for the Buddha to deliver that teaching to these other five very experienced ascetic monks. So it gives you an idea of how condensed the version of it is. Fortunately, many of these points are expanded upon other places in the sutras.
Are you coming in?
This is not working very well?
Not really.
Oh, okay. There's more dukkha. This is microphone dukkha. Okay, maybe I'm going to be careful not to jiggle the wire, and maybe it'll just behave itself. I wonder what's going on here. The battery is good.
You know, the acoustics are pretty good in here. Maybe we don't need it.
Maybe. Let's not give up yet. There's lots of time to give up later. Remind yourself of that every time you get ready to do this. So, fortunately, there are a lot of greater elaborations on dukkha and other parts of the sutras, which help us to understand what's so profound about this. Because one of the things when the Buddha gave this teaching, he introduced it by saying that I've discovered something that no one else has ever taught before. I'm going to tell you something that you've never heard before. Something so different. And then he goes and he says, well, life is full of suffering. He's like, it took you all this to figure that out? So there's more to it than that, the understanding the truth of suffering. As I mentioned last night, we were talking about sukha, how it is one of the Vedanas. And dukkha is its opposite. Dukkha is the unpleasantness, Vedana. And as with sukha, there are two kinds distinguished. There is the dukkha that is physical in origin, and then there's the dukkha that is mental in origin, actually mental in nature. There's physical dukkha and there's mental dukkha. So, really, to understand the importance of this teaching on dukkha is to recognize the relationship between mental dukkha and the other physical kinds of dukkha. Because the important thing, when we translate it as dukkha, as suffering, the important thing to remember is that what the Buddha taught, every time somebody said, you know, so what is your dharma? What are you teaching? He said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. So this is all about the end of suffering. And so somehow we have to understand the relationship of the end of suffering to this first teaching that life is permeated by suffering. Suffering is really mental dukkha. The word in English, suffering, properly speaking, is the mental aspect of dukkha. And you will discover this when you experience dukkha in your meditation, if you meditate on it and examine it, as I think this yogi here has been doing. What you find is that unpleasant sensations arise. They are interpreted by the mind as unpleasant. And if you resist them, you experience mental dukkha. You experience suffering. If you don't resist them, then it's just a sensation, an unpleasant one, And if you approach it with equanimity instead of resistance, if you don't react to it, struggle against it, want to be rid of it, then it loses that quality that makes it suffering. One way that I like to sum this up, in essence, you can say that the first teaching on dukkha is that pain is inevitable. Life is painful in terms of physical dukkha. Birth is painful for the mother and the baby. And you cannot live in this world without experiencing pain. Cuts, burns, insect bites, and much more serious kinds of pain. And to be born, it is absolutely certain that you will die. And death comes when the body ceases to function or is so severely damaged that it can't continue. And that inevitably produces some kind of physical pain. There's physical pain associated with that. So pain in life is inevitable. But, and here's the important part, suffering, the mental anguish, suffering is entirely optional. We could expand that a little bit, and we could say pain and pleasure of the physical sort are inevitable in human life. Both of them. You know, you'll experience both of them. But both the dukkha we refer to as suffering and happiness are optional. And this is the pivot point of everything. We can choose which way that we're going to go. And so that's what's so important about that first teaching on dukkha. And that's the important thing to learn when you experience dukkha in your meditation, to examine the dukkha, to investigate the dukkha, to understand its nature, and to come to that point of realization that pain is just another sensation. It is of the nature of the human body. To be a human being is to experience that type of sensation in one form or another from time to time. But that the reaction of the mind to it is the suffering that we need not experience. And another meditation teacher, very wonderful teacher and good friend of mine, named Shinzen Young, very mathematical kind of guy, and he likes to put everything into equations. And the equation that he puts this into, which is a really good illustration of the point, is that suffering equals pain times resistance. So, if you've got 10 units of pain, you stubbed your toe, and 10 units of resistance to that pain, you're going to experience 100 units of suffering as a result. Right? So it multiplies. The more resistance there is, the greater the suffering. But it also goes the other way. If you have 10 units of pain and only one unit of resistance, you've only got 10 units of suffering, right? But if you're familiar with simple arithmetic, what is a million times zero?
Zero.
It's zero. So when there is no resistance to pain, there is no suffering. It disappears entirely. Which is really what the second truth is about, is that the way it's usually stated is that craving is the cause of suffering. Suffering is the result of craving. And craving, of course, means desire for things, lust, greed, desire for things. But craving includes both sides of the picture. Craving also includes aversion, not wanting things, or wanting not to have things, resistance to things, disgust with things, annoyance with things. And this, so when you understand this, all suffering is due to craving. This comes to the second truth. When he taught the second truth, he said this, but he didn't stop there. He said, you have to realize this. You have to pay attention and realize that every single time you experience suffering, if you look closely, you will find it involves some form of craving. And that's an absolute truth. And any of you that have started working with that practice, and that's a practice, just looking at that, keeping that in mind, anytime you're suffering, it's a red light says, craving present. And you say, okay, let's see if I can find the craving. And sure enough, you'll find it's there all the time. So he said you have to understand this. And then he said, as a part of the teaching on the second truth, he said, if you let go of the craving, there is no suffering. And as a practice, you'll find exactly the same thing is true. If you are practicing meditating on dukkha, either in meditation or just observing it in your daily life, if you can recognize, if you can detect and recognize the craving that is associated with the suffering that you're experiencing in this particular moment, and you let go of it, which you very often you can do that. Not for long, it may be only for a second or for a split second, but for however long you're able to let go of the craving, the suffering will disappear. It'll come back again a moment later. Which leads to the third noble truth, which is about the permanent cessation of craving. If in your experience, every time you experience suffering, it will cease for at least a moment, if during that moment you can let go of the craving, then that leads to the next truth, the conclusion. If you can permanently eliminate craving from your mind stream, you will be permanently free from suffering. There may still be pain in your life, but it will not be a cause of suffering. As those of you who know the life story of the Buddha, he experienced pain. He died, as all human beings do. He was quite ill. He experienced dysentery and things like that. And a few years before that, his jealous cousin Devadatta had tried to kill him on several occasions, one of which he rolled a boulder down the hillside. Boulder didn't hit the Buddha, but it hit another rock and a big sharp splinter flew off and badly lacerated the Buddha's foot so that he could walk on it for some time. Judging by how long he was off of it, probably became infected. So you can imagine how much physical pain you would experience if that happened to you. But in that particular situation, the Buddha would not have needed to experience any suffering at all in associated with those painful events that occurred involving his body. So, yes?
So just a simple example. So you lose a limb in some kind of accident.
Mm-hmm.
And so that causes you suffering because you're missing your arm, say.
Yeah.
So the craving that leads to that suffering is the craving for what?
It's basically all craving is wanting something to be different than the way it is.
So craving two arms.
I want to still have my arm. Or I want to be able to do whatever it is I used to do with my arm. Or, it's wanting things to be different than the way they are. I mean, every kind of craving ultimately comes down to this. You want a beautiful object, you don't have it. It's wanting things to be different than the way they are. You don't have it, you want to have it. It produces the craving in you. You don't have an arm, you want to have an arm. Wanting things to be different than they are. Now, if you don't have a drink of water, but you want a drink of water, you might be able to go and fill up a glass and satisfy that craving. And so you'll experience a brief moment of release. But of course, in the next moment, you'll think of something else that you want or don't want. And a lot of the things that we want and don't want are not cravings that we can fulfill. If you've lost an arm, at least at this stage in the development of medical science, there's no turning that back. There's no getting your arm back. So. Yeah.
So then you don't think that you have to get rid of all the cravings then, right?
Well, you have to understand what craving is, and then you do want to get rid of all of the cravings. Because craving is to be in a state of non-acceptance, and to be in that state of non-acceptance is going to be involve some degree of suffering. Now, okay, so why did you ask that question of not giving up all craving?
Well, because just thirst being one example of that, or if you want to become enlightened, you have to go through all this work to become enlightened, and somebody else is doing it maybe much easier than you, then you kind of give up and say, okay, I'm not going to crave this. So obviously you're not going to be enlightened.
The wish to be enlightened, the desire to be enlightened is... it's a good thing. But even that you have to give up, because the only way that enlightenment is possible is to give up being the person, the self-conceived entity that is going to be enlightened. You know, as one wise master once said, there's no such thing as an enlightened person, only enlightened behavior. And you really, you do have to give that up, because the essence of enlightenment is giving up that attachment to the personal self and to the sense of and belief in a separate existence. And it's something that, yes, it's not easily comprehended. It doesn't lend itself well to being logically figured out. But it is possible, and when it occurs, then a person is truly liberated. So you see, an enlightened being would experience thirst, and because of the thirst, would take appropriate steps to get a glass of water. But they need not suffer thirst. A subtle difference, but it's a very important one. Do you follow it? And the other thing, sometimes there's this misunderstanding that, well, okay, if I have no cravings, if all of my cravings are gone, then why would I ever do anything? Right? But what we mean by craving is that inner compulsion that makes us want things to be different than they are. And it does drive us to do things to make things different. But it does not follow logically from that the only way and the only reason that anyone would ever do something to make things different in the future is to be driven by an inner compulsion, one that's geared to such a primitive level of causing mental pain until you do it. That we don't need that as a motivation. And so, in the case of an enlightened person who has reached the point where they have either minimized or completely eliminated this kind of compulsive craving, they actually are more effective in doing things and producing results that produce a better future. But they're not doing it from a place of rejection and resistance of what is. And that's part of what makes them more capable. So I think when I was speaking about, I don't know if it was in here or with somebody in one of the interviews, about the nature of equanimity. Equanimity means accepting what is completely and totally. What is perfect. And in this moment, not only is this moment perfect, but this moment is ripe with the possibilities, with the potentialities for what you can do to produce a perfect future. So it's filled with opportunities. You don't need to resist what is to be able to see and to act in such a way that it produces change. But you're free of you don't need to be motivated by disgust or anger or grief or any of these other things. Although they work well in a primitive kind of sense. Animals and humans over our evolutionary history, we've accomplished a lot in our mad scramble to try to escape suffering and obtain pleasure. Right? Most of the things that we see as human accomplishments are the result of somebody trying to create a future where that is different than their present. That's true. But they've done it driven by this crude inner mechanism of craving. And the point is that it is possible. You know, we reached a point in our biological evolution that we can undergo another kind of evolution, call it spiritual. It's a good thing to call it. It's a spiritual evolution by which we no longer need to be driven by inherent biological compulsions.
Okay. So is the scientific advancement that human being has made, is it good or is it bad?
It's both and it's neither. I mean, if we look at it objectively from the point of view of the relative reality that we usually live in, science has done a lot of good things, but it's done a lot of bad things. You know, electricity from nuclear power plants is great, but the death and destruction from atomic weapons is terrible. And the same thing applies, you know, pretty much throughout all of our scientific technology. There are ways that it's been used that have been good and ways that not. So it's not inherently in itself good or bad. It has come about through a primitive and ultimately unwholesome approach to life. But the result itself is not necessarily good or bad because of that. And there's no reason why we couldn't accomplish just as much or even more. I mean, just for a moment, imagine if rather than greed, if people's motivation, by and large, in the world, instead of it being the greedy craving for pleasure and happiness that they don't have, or the desire to avoid suffering and insulate themselves from the potential for suffering. That's what, in general, drives the human race right now. But suppose instead of that, we were motivated by loving kindness and compassion. What effect would that have on the critical problems that the world faces right now? With the knowledge we have, with the resources that are still remaining to us, with the science that we have and everything else, what if instead of everything out there being driven by 26-year-old men who want to become multimillionaires with a .com or making products of one kind or selling products to people that don't necessarily need them, and regardless of the impact that the manufacturer of that has on the resources available and so on. So, I mean, you know, I don't need to get into all that kind of stuff. This is the world we live in. Well, what would it be like if we could just magically, you know, flip a button and all of these same people with all the same intelligence and all the same abilities and everything else instead were motivated by the desire to create a better future for everyone, not just for themselves, to solve the problem, to heal the sick, to ensure that we don't arrive at some point where the world is overcome by famines, uncontrollable diseases, and ecological disasters. Can you see the potential there? So we don't need to be driven by craving. It got us where we are, but it also got us where we are in both the sense of the good things that we enjoy, and especially in this country, do we ever enjoy a lot of good things? Oh, yes. Mm. Right? We're really blessed. But we are also facing the most enormously frightening future for exactly the same reason, because of exactly the same things that we've done. So.
Okay.
Yes? All right.
Well,
Neil? Yes.
So can you talk about desire versus craving? I mean, they're different, right? And can you, or maybe they're not, but can you say what's different about them if they are different?
Well, there's a sort of semantic thing. It's not so much that, well, for one thing, craving includes both desire and aversion. It includes both the positive and negative side. So craving is a much more all-encompassing term than desire. Although I suppose you could say desire to be free from pain and so forth. Yeah, okay. So anyway, it's not so much that they're different as the way we use them. So, you know, and this is something that sometimes comes up, has sort of come up tonight. People start teaching the Dharma, and the message that comes across is desire is a bad thing. And then the question comes up, well, what about the desire for enlightenment? Or what about the desire to help other people? Or what about the desire for a better world? And here, we realize that this same word is used to mean things that don't, they're not really exactly the same thing. The desire to see the end of someone else's suffering is compassion. And the Dharma teaching is that we want to eliminate desire, but we don't want to eliminate compassion. So obviously, we want to eliminate one kind of desire. But there are other ways that we can use the word desire that are not referring to what we're talking about. So this is one thing to understand, that when we use the word desire in reference to that which we would like to be free of, it is that compulsion. And it is, it's a compulsion. That compulsion, that really, really deep-rooted compulsion that comes from our resistance and non-acceptance of what is.
I thought there was a different kind of difference. Desire is more, I think of it as more like a fact, like I see a really fancy car, and I can have desire mm-hmm. for that car, because it's a recognition that I appreciate it, or whatever you want to say. But then I could still not crave it. Like, I'm not willing to work extra hours. It's not going to make me miserable because I don't have it. So even though I recognize that it would be nice and I'd like it, I still don't have to crave it.
Well, once again, it's different ways of using the word, because as far as I'm concerned, the difference is not, in both cases, you desire the car. And I would say in both cases you crave the car. But the difference is that in one case you have sense enough to realize that that's not the best utilization of your time and energy. And in the other, you are so overwhelmed by your desire that you don't have that ability to make that discrimination. But the underlying mental phenomena is the same.
So it's just more or less out of that. I have some craving, but not enough to go
right.
to work extra.
Yeah, right. Okay. But that brings us to the other thing that I think is really important. You know, when somebody does a Dharma teaching and the message you get is, well, desire is not a good thing, therefore I should try not to desire anything. Well, that is ridiculous. Because until you actually reach the third of the four stages of enlightenment, you're going to experience desire, period. As you go, as you advance to the first and second to the third stages, the power that your desires have over you is going to diminish. But until you become what's called a non-returner, you are going to experience craving. You're going to experience desire and aversion. So let's be realistic. Let's not say, oh my goodness, desire is a bad thing. You try to negate every kind of desire. Guess I won't desire to help the poor. That's a desire. I won't desire to become enlightened. That's a desire. Besides which, I was getting tired of sitting in meditation. That's a nonsense view. Until you're enlightened, you're going to have craving. But if you're intelligent, you can at least make some sort of discrimination. You can, at the very least, decide not to put all your time and energy into trying to get a car, because you can recognize that the satisfaction it's going to give you is very short-lived and the cost is going to be enormous, right? You can also discriminate between desires that are beneficial. I would guess, I mean, I don't know, but I would just guess, based on probabilities, that a lot of young men have become interested in the Dharma because an attractive young woman suggested they go together to a Dharma talk. You know, and that's not a bad outcome of desire. So, a desire for enlightenment is a good thing. And to the degree that, as long as you're experiencing desire, you know, and craving and things like that, try to put your time and energy into those kinds of desires that are going to have the most beneficial outcomes. But you can keep in mind all the time that the direction you're heading is the ultimate freedom from compulsive craving in every form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How is creation, or the desire to create, you know, have this sort of innate, you're curious beings, and it's pleasurable to create. How is that different from desire, or it's just a degree of compulsion, or the attachment to it?
To engage in creative activities, it's really not that different than anything else. You can desire creative activities because of the admiration and rewards that they'll give you, or you can desire creative activities because they make you feel good. You might make yourself happy. You know, if I do something creative, then I'll feel good for a while afterwards. I like that, you know. If I have a project, I really enjoy looking at it afterwards and feeling the good feeling that it gives me, you know. Just, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's a pretty healthy, wholesome kind of thing for us to pursue. You want joy. You want joy and happiness in your life. That's all right. It's all how you go about getting it. And to want to be a happy person is not a bad thing. How you go about choosing to make yourself happy is a different story.
Yeah. What's going to happen to words like ambition and striving?
Well,
you're going to drop out of the vocabulary as people become less.
You mean if this teaching catches on and circles the globe and
yes,
everybody becomes enlightened? Well, like with all words, they'll take on a new meaning. We'll still use them, but usually when we speak of a person being ambitious, there's some positive and some negative elements to that. The positive is we see that they're highly motivated, they're highly productive, they use their skills and abilities in a very effective way because of their ambition. And so it has a positive side to it. But we also, very often when we speak of somebody as ambitious, it's not always in praise. because of the many of the things that people do out of ambition are harmful and destructive to people, to society, to themselves, all kinds of things like that. So I see in a world of enlightened beings, we would probably still use the word ambition, but it would lose certain connotations and certain others would be more fully developed in it, I think. Striving, an athlete can strive to improve their performance, and it means, in that regard, it means doing the best that they're capable of and trying to overcome the hindrances of laziness or fatigue or, you know, things like this, doubt, that would stand in the way of their performing at their absolute best. And so in that regard, striving is a really good thing. If, to give you a situation, a person with equanimity, who doesn't reject the present, who sees everything as absolutely perfect the way it is, but also conceives of a course of action that has the potential to make things better or perhaps to ease the suffering of someone else. This is our scenario. Now, we could use the word strive to describe the process by which they would undertake to do this to the very best of their ability. And that would be a good if they beat themselves up if their expectations weren't met, then that's not such a good thing. But to actually be motivated to do your absolute best, this is where I would like to be 100% of the time, every minute, every hour, every day for the rest of my life. And it is what I strive for, to do the best that I can, to be the best that I can. And I find that I'm able to do that, I'm more able to do that, if I'm not attached to the outcome. If I have an if I'm attached to my idea of the way things are supposed to go, and they don't go that way, I have lost an enormous amount of flexibility. And when things don't go that way, it robs me of a huge amount of my energy. But if I can do my best in whatever situation I find myself, and also accept my limitations, you know, I mean, it's not just that the situation didn't go the way I wanted to, but sometimes I don't perform the way I wanted to. Or I'm not capable of quite meeting every task the way that I would like to have. But if in that very moment I can accept where I am and I can say, well, I did my best, and so therefore, even though it didn't turn out, I've succeeded. All I really wanted to do was do the best I could, not be something that I'm not. You see what I'm saying? If you want to be something you're not, then you're doomed sooner or later to be disappointed and suffer. But if you're willing to make your best effort and accept the result, then you're always as successful as you could possibly have been.
In a world where you have enlightened, ambitious people, mm-hmm. and unenlightened, ambitious people, mm-hmm. who do you think is going to get into the positions of where you don't want them?
Going to get in the position of
power,
whatever. Power and things like
lots
that.
Lots of places where you don't want these people.
I don't know. I've never really tried to imagine that scenario. But I think there's some reason to believe that in that kind of world where there were enough enlightened people to be noticeable, that what you would see, well, I think we have an example in this world. The Dalai Lama, he was in 1959 pretty obscure. For that matter, Tibet was pretty obscure. I would guess that most people in this country, most people in the world, did not have the faintest idea. They may have heard the name Tibet in school geography or something, but most of them had no idea about Tibet. But today, the Dalai Lama is one of the most widely recognized and widely admired human beings on the planet, and he stands as an example to many people. So that's a form of power, you know. And it's a very positive form of power. I think if we lived in a world where there were a lot of enlightened beings, that what we would see is that these enlightened beings would rise to positions of power and influence. Whether or not they'd become president of the United States or not, I don't know, but maybe at some point they would, and that would be wonderful if they did. I think they have an inherent advantage over unenlightened, ambitious people. I think that they can use their own resources actually more effectively. But this is, we're really getting into the realm of speculation. But that is my, that's the view that I would, I'd like to live in a world where we discovered the answer to that. There are a lot of enlightened beings, enough of them around that we could say, well, yeah, look, see, you know, that's the way it's happening. Yeah.
And you know, before you just talked about that, you mentioned the type of person who believes that there's something that they're not versus the person who accepts their limitations. Mm-hmm. How does one shift from the former to the latter?
Through practicing mindfulness and cultivating equanimity. you need the mindfulness to know what you are capable of, and to know what your limitations are, and to come to that point where you can understand the way things really are. You have to have some understanding of the way things really are for this to be truly effective. But even with a modicum of mindfulness, a person who understands and appreciates their own capabilities and limitations is in a better position to accept them and can develop equanimity. But in that case, we're still talking about improvements of ordinary human beings, unenlightened human beings, you know, experiencing the world from an unawakened perspective. An awakened being has already basically solved those problems and made the transition. So you start where you are and you apply the same principles. You practice mindfulness and equanimity, and you keep moving in that direction. Yes?
If you don't mind, I would like to see if we can continue our topic for the...
Yes. Well, I'm just waiting for somebody to express some thoughts or ask some questions about joy and meditation. We got started off on something else here, which has been interesting and productive, mm-hmm. but we can certainly say enough of that for the time being. We probably have talked about that enough for the moment. Always come back to it again. What about joy, though?
I want some joy, and I want it right now.
You're going to suffer.
I actually gave up my craving for joy and I felt better.
Actually, that's a joke, but there's truth in that. The, you know, for ordinary joy, you know, if you give up your craving for ordinary joy, you might just stop doing things that give you enjoyment. But when you begin to experience the arising of piti, if you become attached to it, and if you start grasping after it, it slips away from you. So you have to cultivate that attitude of letting go and letting it come by itself. So you really do have to, and that's where that's a really good place to start practicing letting go of craving is. It actually has a counterpart. You know, if you meditate on pain and the pain disappears, like, oh wow, fabulous. And then next time you got pain, you say, oh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to meditate on it and make it go away. Well, the reason it went away the first time is you got to this place of accepting it. You stopped resisting it. But now you're still resisting it. I'm going to meditate on it so hard it goes away. Well, that's just another form of resistance. That's probably not going to work. You have to let go of those. You have to let go of that craving to get the reward. So what else on joy? What were some of the things that, there were a whole number of, you know, let me tell you, there's so much I could tell you about this. First of all, I'd stay here till the sun came up and your knees and your back would be so sore by the time I finished talking. I could go on for days. So you've got to help me by telling me what's on your mind and what you want to hear about.
Yeah, last night you mentioned about there are five levels of the joy.
Five grades of arising of piti, of meditative joy. Yeah. And that's probably a really good point for us to continue this discussion. Yeah. I'm going to go over time again. Okay. Now, you're clear from last night that meditative joy comes as part of a package, right? It involves physical sensations of a great variety, visual sensations of lights, auditory sensations, the illumination phenomenon. And for some people, it also involves taste and smell, the nectar and the fragrance. So when we talk about the way PT arises, we have to realize that we're talking about all of those things, not just the joyful feeling. Okay? So, yes, there's five grades of arising of PT. The first is called momentary. Or no, minor. First is called minor, second is called momentary. Minor PT is totally unpredictable when it comes. Usually doesn't last very long, pretty brief. And it may involve only one of this spectrum of phenomena, or two or three, but not all of them. I mean, most often it's just one or two. So minor PT, you may just have a sudden, you know, an upsurge of something and a strong feeling of joyful happiness. Totally unexpected. Doesn't last a long time. It's really delightful. Didn't come with any bright light. You know, you didn't hear the angels sing. It was just that by itself. That would be an example of minor PT. So would it be if you're sitting in meditation and you suddenly experience a brilliant white light, or you see colored flashes like there's fireworks going on behind your closed eyelids, or you might suddenly see a colored orb off in the corner of your visual field and it kind of drifts across, or a smoky lightness. And if that happens by itself, that still qualifies as minor PT. You may not have any more joy other than the excitement that comes from, oh wow, this is different. Hey, this is kind of like that stuff that I heard about. I wonder if I'm going to be enlightened. Yeah. which is a kind of joy, but it's a very mild kind. Sometimes minor PT takes the form of really strange things. You feel chills, you know, going over your body, or strange itchy sensations, or you might feel like a vibration just all over your skin or something like that. In other words, minor PT is an unpredictable, short-lived phenomenon that involves one or a few of the components of fully developed PT. The next grade, and minor PT can show up almost any time. Usually people in the fourth stage of the stages of meditation will have from time to time some experience of this. And it can also happen sometimes outside of meditation. If you've been meditating a lot or you're on a retreat, you may have these PT experiences while you're doing something else. And they can show up pretty well any time, sometimes as early as the third stage, more likely in the fourth stage, fifth, sixth. By the time you get to the sixth and seventh stages, they're pretty likely that you'll have had at least a few occasions of minor PT, minor PT. Okay, next of the five grades. The first four are all incomplete and interrupted PT. Right? Okay, so the next grade is called momentary, because it doesn't last very long. It's still pretty unpredictable, and it usually involves a larger combination of the different things that are different aspects of PT. So a feeling of joy combined with illumination, and maybe a sound, maybe some vibratory feeling in your body or electrical pulses or something like that. It happens more frequently, and you tend to notice that it's usually when you're having a pretty good meditation and your concentration is good and you're really relaxed, when you're not pushing yourself and striving too hard, that you'll have these episodes of momentary PT. So it may seem unpredictable, but actually, if you pay attention to when momentary PT arises, you begin to see some of the signs of what the conditions are that cause it to arise, which are a certain degree of stability of attention, which is really a reflection of unification of mind. So doesn't mean that you've got perfect deep concentration, but you're less distractible, your mind is calmer, your mind is more focused and coherent, and you're in a more relaxed and less kind of striving, pushing, struggling, resisting, I want to do this, I don't want to do that kind of place. You just kind of like, there it is. The third grade, still of incomplete and uninterrupted PT, is called wave-like. And here, usually there will be a number of, there will be several of the PT factors, the joy, the illumination, and bodily sensations. I'll just point out, not very many people get the fragrance and the nectar. More than that, but still not very many, get much in the way of auditory phenomena. A lot of people get the illumination phenomenon. And just about everybody gets the body sensations thing. So when you're experiencing the grade of PT that's called wave-like, there will be some sorts of body sensations, and good chance there will be some movement or salivation or some other autonomic nervous system phenomenon that accompanies that. And there will be the joy. There will be a feeling of joy. And it's called wave-like because it doesn't just come and it's there for a short time and then it goes away. But it comes and it intensifies and then it kind of subsides, you know, like a wave goes out. And then a few minutes later it comes back up again and it reaches a peak. And then so you'll have this period of it coming and going, several or even quite a few times. At first, when you experience this wave-like PT, there is a tendency to get excited, to sort of lose your concentration, and you may get one or two waves and then it's gone. But basically, when the PT is lasting longer and it's becoming fairly intense and then dies off, then that's the wave-like. And it'll have a pretty fair combination of the classical things that are attributed to PT present. Another description that's sometimes given to this third grade of PT is showering. And this has to do, I think, with, as I say, the most common thing to be associated with the joy are bodily sensations. And often they just, you'll get a wave of sensation passing over your body. It's like, a showering sensation of pleasantness or tingling or electric or something like that. But I think really wave-like is probably a more apt description for, at least for what most people describe to me in their meditation interviews, things like that, is the wave-like. It sort of comes in surges, and if they get too caught up in it, it goes away. But then, you know, the next day or a couple of days later, it'll come back. And if they can learn to just sort of ride with it and not chase after it, it'll continue to get stronger. So that's the third grade of interrupted and incomplete PT. The fourth is called uplifting. And this is really strong. And it's strong and it can last a little while. And the sensations a person experiences are usually quite well developed. You may feel as though you've lost awareness of your body, or that your body has become just, you know, this little shell of sensation with no substance to it, or you may no longer feel gravity, you feel like you're floating in the air. Or very often you'll have the feeling that your body's in a completely different position than you know it is. It may just be you feel like you're leaned way over the side, but you know, if you peek, you'll realize that, no, I'm still straight up. But it can be, you know, like often when I have strong PT coming on like that, I'll have this feeling that I'm standing up rather than sitting down. Even though I know I'm sitting down cross-legged, I'll feel like I'm standing up. That's just one of the ways it happens with me. So this is a very strong form of PT, and usually by this time, you've already got a pretty good idea of those subtle elements of attitude that you need to hold in order to allow this to happen and allow it to persist for any length of time. The full development of PT, which is the fifth grade, is called pervasive. It's very intense, comparatively speaking, with the others. And whatever of these other phenomena you're experiencing are also going to be fully developed. So if you experience pervasive PT, you feel really, really joyful. The sensation in your body is usually one that all ordinary tactile sensation has disappeared, and your body just simply feels pleasurable all over. It feels really, really pleasurable, really good. It may feel weightless, it may feel insubstantial, it may feel it's in a different position. Any of these other things may be part of it. But it will be pleasurable, and it will be very distinctly different than your ordinary perception of your body. The illumination phenomenon may have, in these other grades, you may have gone through periods of flashing lights or orbs of light passing through your visual field, or periods of varying intensity that maybe seem to be coming from out there or something like that. Usually with fully developed pervasive PT, the light is an all-pervading light. It seems to come either from everywhere and pervade everything, like it has no particular source. Or interesting thing is you may feel like it's coming from your chest, or you may feel like it's coming from the top of your head. Which is really interesting if you think about religious iconography. Throughout the world, religious traditions, religious depictions of people show light coming from their chest and light coming from their head. And there's no doubt in my mind where the inspiration for these illustrations come from. One thing about the illumination phenomenon is that it may be very colored at first, but in the fully developed PT, it usually is only very, very faintly colored. It tends to be a clear white or almost white light. The other thing the reason it's often called an all-pervading light has to do with your perception of it. Now, you can't actually see with your eyes what's behind you, right? But when you're experiencing this light, it's as though you are aware of it behind you and above you and all those places that your field of vision doesn't reach to. So basically, the fully developed PT, strong joy, and whichever of the other manifestations that have appeared for you, the ones that have continued and developed fully, they'll become quite strong and quite pleasant and very distinctly different than your ordinary sensory perceptions. Let me tell you a few other things about this. Not everybody experiences all of these, and not everybody experiences even the joy in quite the same way. It's like each of us has sort of a different threshold for joy, and we also seem to have like a different level of intensity that it comes to, and it seems to be inherent to a person. So there's some people that they're going to feel a lot of joy even the first few experiences of minor or momentary PT they have. Whereas others, it's going to be more of, well, that was nice, rather than exuberant and exciting. And actually, they may not even really have an experience that they, I'm not sure I'd really call that joy, it was nice, at least until they get to the later stages and it gets fairly intense. So there's individual variations. And then some people, when PT is fully developed, are going to be so effusively overflowing with joy that they just about can't stay in their skin. And these kind of people will usually get up from the meditation seat because they have to go tell somebody. And they'll often go and tell the meditation teacher, I got to tell you about this. This is wonderful. Blah, 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 blah. Whereas for other people, it's joy, all right, but I'm not jumping up and down. I don't need to. I can just enjoy it. It's a really nice state of mind to be in. I wouldn't mind being like this all the time, but I don't know what this other person's up to. There's differences. So don't develop expectations. Don't be disappointed if you don't see lights. Most people have bodily experiences. Not everybody sees lights. What I notice is the people that see lights tend not to have as intense bodily experiences. I don't know how general that rule is. I haven't been teaching long enough. I haven't seen enough people to draw hard and fast conclusions. But the impression that I've gotten, there's a group of people who, when PT starts to arise, will have really strong body PT. Energy movements, bodily movements. And if that's really strong, then they will often tend not to have really strong illumination phenomena. Whereas these other kinds, and I'm one of these, where for me, strong energy feelings didn't come till later. And what I would always notice is just my thumbs would start to twitch and my mouth would, I'd be swallowing my thumbs. And then I'd get this nice little rush of pleasure. But I did get the light. I did really strong illumination, so sort of minimal level bodily component and big visual. So there's a huge amount of variation in this. You can't judge yourself against other people or against the classic description. Yes?
Do you have to be in the jhana to experience PT?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, PT comes before jhana, and you can't really experience any of the deep jhanas until you've already experienced PT. As a matter of fact, I'm a little hesitant here because I'm going to be giving a talk on jhanas next month, and a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is what this word means and the way it's used. So, jhana just basically means absorption. And you can deliberately enter into some very, very light absorptions and thereby increase your experience of PT. But when you start talking about the deeper absorptions, what I would call the deeper jhanas, you've got to go through all the stages. You've got to reach to the unification of mind and effortlessness and the strong arising of PT, and even a certain degree of the next phase, which is a subsidence of PT, before you can really enter into those deeper jhanas. Light jhanas is not necessary. There's a kind of light jhana that if the only PT you've got is some strong energy sensations and you can produce a pleasant feeling in your chest or your face or your hands and focus on that, then you can enter the jhana and then the PT will become stronger as a result of that. But the deeper jhanas, you've got to have already worked your way through the PT first. Yes?
I would like to clarify that. So PT also you will experience the very comfortable for the body.
Yes.
But I thought that is not a happiness.
Well, there's usually mental pleasantness, which we call happiness, and bodily pleasure at the same time. There's a good feeling of pleasure in the body, and there's also happiness in the mind.
Okay, so if you experience that the body is so comfortable and so light, and that is a joy.
That's a part of PT. And in the milder forms of arising of PT, your body might feel really, really pleasant, and your mind is just, you know, oh, this is really nice. I like this, but it's not that exuberant, effervescent kind of joy. But the two tend to come together and they reinforce each other. I mean, when your body feels really good, your mind tends to be happy, right? You tend to be happy about the situation and they'll reinforce each other.
When you're doing breathing meditation, is it important to just to breathe naturally, or should you purposely try to breathe in a certain way so that you can focus on it?
Well, there are definitely methods that you can use where you more deliberately control and use the breath itself. But for the practice that I'm teaching, we're more concerned with the mind. And so we would like to use we'd like to let the body breathe by itself and take a much more objective, and unattached, and uninvolved stance. So, but you can go either way, and there are a lot of very powerful methods that involve deliberately breathing in certain ways.
Is there a point, like an enlightenment, or one of the stages of enlightenment, where joy becomes permanent or largely permanent, or is it just one of these things that will come and go?
Well, I'll have to expand on this a little bit more. And it's important to understand that the arising of PT is sort of an intermediate stage in meditative development and is not necessarily connected to enlightenment. But that it's very easy to mistake PT for enlightenment. Okay? In the normal development of samatha, in the eighth stage, you're working with the complete arising of PT, with the pervasive PT, as it's called. And it's intense. And then you move to the ninth stage, and the ninth stage is really all about getting used to the PT so that its intensity subsides. It doesn't disappear. The joy stays, and the pleasant bodily sensations stay, what now there develops a strong sense of tranquility. It's not so energetic, it's not so agitated, it's much more peaceful. It is actually more pleasant. And by comparison, the PT before it subsided in intensity and the tranquility has developed is not as nice. I mean, it's very exciting, it's very wonderful. It's like, you know, it's like a rush from a super drug, but it gets old. And that's actually an important stage of it. It gets old, you get used to it, and then it begins to subside, and tranquility develops and equanimity develops, and then you're moving into the tenth stage. Now, on the way to enlightenment, as your meditation skills improve, you will develop PT, and you know, you can become enlightened at any time. It's not necessary to work your way through the full development of any meditation process. You can become enlightened at any time. But until you become enlightened, you might as well keep on working on the process, because it increases the probabilities. So you might have already gone through the intensity of PT and the subsidence of the intensity of PT and the arising of tranquility and equanimity. And then when enlightenment occurs, it's followed by what's called the fruition experience. And this is a very blissful experience. The mind is definitely in the state that we call PT. And there is a lot of sukha. So there's rapture and bliss. But and probably because somebody once said, maybe a literary person in here could help me with this. Somebody once said, there's nothing like being hung in the morning to concentrate your mind tonight, or focus your mind tonight, right? You know the reference there.
It's actually Dostoevsky said that there's nothing like being in front of a firing squad.
it's the same principle. It's probably many people have used this example. But there's also nothing like the full experience of insight and awakening to focus your mind. If you've never experienced jhana before, especially any of the deep, strong jhanas, then if you have an awakening experience, you're going to be totally focused, and you're going to be totally focused for some time afterwards. The mind is unified. The mind's unified, there's going to be PT and sukha. So this is the way it happens. So if you read the descriptions of what awakening is like, you're always going to encounter descriptions of the rapture and the bliss that are associated with the fruition. But that's not the most important part of it. The most important part of it is the wisdom, the understanding, the completely different perspective from which you see things. So the bliss is almost incidental. That answer your question?
Yeah, and then that does subside, though?
Yes, it does.
After the fruition?
It does subside. So, okay, yeah, I remember the other part of your question. It does, and as a person advances to second path and third path, their ability to repeat and prolong these fruition experiences increases, and can't tell you for sure, but as far as I understand it, once you become a Buddha, you're pretty much you really transcended our normal condition, but the psychophysical entity of a fully enlightened being probably exists in this state of rapture and bliss all the time.
I do have a question regarding the PT. During the practice, I'm not quite understand. Maybe something is not quite well for my practice or what. Experience a lot of physical physical sensation, a lot of strong rapture, and sometimes very strong energy, and sometimes cause some even kind of uncomfortable.
Yes.
And that's like wave and so strong. But or other type of the physical thing. However, the mental status, joy, that not that strong. Then later on, the body come and become so comfortable. At that time, getting sense some part of the mental joy, but not that strong, and become so more, instead of talk about joy, maybe say it's more peaceful,
tranquil, tranquility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't have that happy mental status, the joy. So it's something quite not well. So it's...
No, you agree that you're experiencing joy, but that it progresses to tranquility, right?
Yeah, but the joy is not really distinguished.
You think back a year ago, 2 years ago, that the joy that you experienced on some of the retreats.
Yeah.
That was pretty out of sight, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then later on, not really.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, you're getting used to it. You don't, your mind doesn't need to launch into that kind of state in the same way. It's got a better place to go.
Oh.
Or to put it in physiological terms, there's probably some circuits in your brain releasing certain neurotransmitters that they did that to open up new pathways. But now that the new pathways are opened up, they don't need to do it with the same intensity to get you to this place of tranquility. So what you're describing is don't worry about it. It's a normal.
So it's fine. It's a normal. Do not have a mental.
Yeah.
Part of it.
Okay. In the Mahayana tradition, they break this down even a little more completely. So that instead of just talking about the rising of PT, they talk about mental pliancy and physical pliancy. The mental pliancy referring to the unification of mind and the concentration, and the physical pliancy referring to the place that you get where you're not disturbed by sensory phenomenon, because now your body is feeling so nice and pleasant and wonderful, and you know, you're seeing a beautiful light and hearing a wonderful sound, or that's the physical pliancy, followed by what's called the bliss of mental pliancy and the bliss of physical pliancy. Now that's referring to that intense joy and to the pleasant physical sensations. And then, as they describe the sequence, and this is the way it really happens, Sue, the bliss of physical pliancy and bliss of mental pliancy are followed by the subsidence of the bliss of mental pliancy. And as it subsides, as this bliss subsides, this is where the tranquility and the equanimity arise. And then that also followed by the subsidence of the bliss of physical pliancy. And that's actually a very refined state of consciousness where you basically, not only are you not aware of normal sensations, but rather your body is just the locus of a lot of pleasantness, you really pretty much lose awareness of the body. So even the pleasantness fades away, and there's just like a ghostly vestige in your mind of awareness of your body. So this is a more complete description of it. And so where you are is you are working through the stages of the subsidence of the bliss of mental pliancy, and you know there are always variations on this, but if you follow the classic pattern, you'll also be experiencing diminished awareness of your body, not just diminished awareness of ordinary and uncomfortable sensations, but diminished awareness of your body altogether. Okay. So don't worry, you're on track. Yes?
Yeah. Will this make you a better person? How will it make you a better person?
Okay. Well, I really want to answer that question. First, is there anybody that's absolutely dying to go to the bathroom? You want to continue? Okay,
yes.
Good. All right. Well, let's just speak in terms of samatha, because we talk about PT arising and you getting to the place in your practice where you can experience PT regularly. And then as it subsides, tranquility and equanimity arising. Now, when this happens, you start to have the same joy, tranquility, and equanimity even when you get up from meditating. It stays with you. And so, because you have PT as a state of mind, remember I discussed PT was a state of mind. PT is a state of mind that is conducive to pleasant experience, and it even minimizes the unpleasantness of unpleasant experiences. So this means that a person with PT gets up from the cushion and they go out in the world, and the effect of desire and aversion is hugely attenuated in them. As a matter of fact, it can be so completely attenuated that it's said to be completely suppressed. Have you ever heard it said that when you reach access concentration, which is the equivalent of samatha, by the way, that the five hindrances are completely suppressed? Have you ever heard that teaching? No?
Yeah, they are suppressed. But you
but they're not gone. They're just suppressed.
These are not sustained, you know, mm-hmm. for that moment there.
Okay, well, as it starts out, they're completely suppressed while you're sitting in meditation. But if you can do this consistently, if you can practice this way consistently, what's going to happen is they're going to stay suppressed when you get up, go out in the world. A person who for whom the hindrances are suppressed is not being driven by desire and aversion. So they are a much better person. They are also a much happier person, more at ease, less likely to be disturbed. So it does make you a better person in that way. But the thing to keep in mind is that to sustain this, you have to be able to keep practicing. So, and to be able to practice where you are reaching these particular levels of practice. If something happens in it, you can't. Your practice is interrupted. Your mind starts going back to the way it was before. The suppressed hindrances come back to life again. And you start to lose it. Or you get sick. You get sick, and because you're sick, you can't practice with the same intensity. You know, or you get old and you start to develop Alzheimer's or dementia or something like that. What's going to happen? This is just a temporary thing due to causes and conditions, and the causes and conditions are being able to sit down and meditate in a particular way. So while you're in this state, you're a better person. If you meditate in this state so that enough of it carries over into your daily life, even if in your daily life you haven't got complete suppression of the five hindrances, you're still going to be a better person. But your better personness is dependent upon causes and conditions vulnerable to being lost, easily lost. Some big disaster happens, your house is carried away in a California mudslide, you might lose it all and you'll stop being a better person. See what I mean? So yes, it makes you a better person, but it's not the solution we're looking for. Everything that happens to you in the course of meditation will make you a better person. But until you reach awakening, you're always subject to losing what you've gained and backsliding. Okay? Okay. I don't mind continuing this conversation after we take a break. And I also don't mind if we come back and meditate. So we are going to meditate before we end the evening. We're going to take a 15-minute break now. So I do want to add just a little bit to what I was saying before, and then this will be enough for tonight. This last very good question that was asked by Pushpa. Will piti make you a better person? Piti is very important. And I've given you some indication of that already. The Buddha identified it as one of the seven factors of enlightenment. And throughout the sutras, you'll find many, many references to piti in different contexts. So this meditative joy is no small thing or insignificant thing in terms of the path to enlightenment. But sometimes it is misunderstood. And because it is misunderstood by people experiencing it, I think that has led to it being misunderstood in some schools of thought. In the system of practice that it's very old, it comes from a text called the Visuddhimagga. They're described 16 stages or knowledges in the path to enlightenment. And one of these knowledges is called the knowledge of what is and is not the path. And in that particular description, they describe 10 defilements of insight. And piti is mentioned as one of them. And so we need to look at that. If you look at those 10 so-called defilements, you'll see that 9 of them are actually very good, very valuable qualities that you strive to develop in your practice, both in meditation and outside of it. It's only the 10th one that makes the group of 10 to be problematic. The 10th one is attachment to the other 9. The problem, you remember this is called the knowledge of what is and is not the path. The problem is that somebody can reach this point with, then they'll develop strong piti, they develop tranquility and equanimity together with that. And equanimity is one of these defilements too. So, and you know, if they're practicing intensively, they'll have some remarkable experiences, and they may be convinced that this is the path. This is what it's all about. This is enlightenment. This is the purpose of the whole thing. And so this particular stage that you pass through when there is strong piti and these other highly desirable qualities is one in which you come to recognize that this isn't the final goal. This is just something that happens along the way. So, yes, it is something that can be mistaken. I think anybody that practices in the proper way would probably be not more than very temporarily deceived by this. I think it is part of the natural development of the practice that anyone who reaches the stage where piti and sukha and pasadi and upekkha are very well developed, they may dwell in that for some time, but it is inevitable that they are going to recognize that this is still unsatisfactory and continue in their practice from that point. And if they have a teacher, that teacher is probably going to point it out to them right away. So when back in whatever it was, 800 AD when Visuddhimagga was written, it wasn't the intention to say that piti is a bad thing or that piti is a mistake. Chi-Chi is a very important part of the practice, but it's to say that it's not to be mistaken for the goal of the practice and the end of the practice, because there's much more beside that. Okay? And as I pointed out, it can make you a better person temporarily, but it's temporary. It's due to causes and conditions. Sometimes this is misunderstood, though, and distorted. And there's some teachings which will even warn you against doing samatha practices, because you'll experience PT, and if you experience PT, you'll get trapped in that joy and you'll never find your way out again, and you'll be lost forever for another 100,000 lifetimes on the cycle of birth and death. So stay away from that nasty PT. And that's not very realistic. It is one of the seven factors of enlightenment. It's often spoken of as a very important part of the path. And it is extremely important to meditative development. And what I'm hoping to communicate to all of you is that it's not something that you need to wait for, and once your practice gets good enough in a whole other set of technical terms, PT will arrive delivered by UPS or FedEx. Ding dong, here it is. But that actually you can develop all of those other skills that are associated with it more quickly if you cultivate joy and if you cultivate exactly the kind of mental or behaviors of mind that PT brings about when it is present. Okay? That's all I really wanted to add to that discussion there, to clarify.